This is Chris Bacon, composer for Bates Motel, and you're listening to Good Evening.
Good evening, and welcome to an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I am one of your frankly fantastic co-hosts tonight. My name's Chris Haig, and I am joined tonight, as always, by the excellent Brandon Shea Matala and the rather fantastic Tom Caldwell. How are we doing, guys?
Very good. Thank you for that intro. Like Chris says, he's always good for an intro.
I'm always good for an intro, and I'm not so great at anything else. That's
alright. You're great at laughing while you talk, which is wonderful. It makes it happy and jolly. I'm doing fantastic. I'm really looking forward to today's episode because I really enjoyed this movie.
It is. It's a good film. So for reference, this is episode 7. I can't believe we're up to episode 7 already. And we are covering the 1927, practically a classic, The Lodger. Which is, I think it's the first one of Hitchcock's that's a full print version has been kind of available to the public and everything. And it's his earliest one. And yeah.
Yeah, because when we watched The Pleasure Garden, it was a little bit of a truncated version. Because I think, if I remember correctly, Wikipedia listed it as 85 minutes.
Mm.
And we listened to like an hour, or we watched like an hour version of it, so there's a little bit missing there.
Yeah, there's probably like a reel missing or something that they weren't able to find. But no, it is. So we'll be talking about The Lodger, we'll be talking about the restoration process and kind of the Criterion Collection, and we'll be talking about all kinds of other awesome stuff as well. But I'm going to hand over to these guys now.
I'm going to do our quick Hitchcock trivia. You two are the contestants. Did you guys bring noisemakers?
I ate a lot of beans.
Oh, man. So much for the classy part of the show. Okay, here we go. Two quick questions. What is wrong with seeing London's Tower Bridge in the film The Lodger?
What's wrong with it? Yeah. Oh, my.
I'm from the UK. Ding, 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 ding. I should know this.
It didn't exist.
Yeah, I was going to say, at the time frame of the movie,
maybe the bridge wasn't built yet.
Yeah.
And one more quickie, since we're on a roll. You guys are doing so well. What significant event happened to Mr. Hitchcock in 1956?
1956. Ooh. Jeez.
As a career move, what did he strive for a long
ding,
time?
Ding, ding, ding.
Pardon?
An Oscar?
No. He became a naturalized American citizen.
Oh. He moved to Hollywood,
right? And that, of course, is always the definition of success in film, is living in California, working in Hollywood. So that was a big deal. And those are my two trivia questions. Neither one of you got any points.
Zero for zero. Yeah. So instead of a cookie, we get a pie in the face.
Yeah, there you go. I'll hand it back over to Chris.
Before we pass it off to Chris there, I'll just keep talking here a little bit. I've got Brandon's trivia on the movie. So this is a little bit about the production history of the film and whatnot. And The Lodger was released on February 14th, 1927 in the UK. Valentine's Day. What a beautiful film to go see with your honey on a Valentine's Day. The running time on the film is 91 minutes, and the version that Tom and I watched was the new Criterion Collection Blu-ray edition. Tom, how did that film look?
Amazing.
Yeah, it sure did.
Brandon has this projector that I'm pretty sure he stole from a Cineplex. What is it, a 3D 1080p projector on a big screen? And we watched this film, and the clarity was amazing. The visual integrity of this restoration is well worth it if you get a chance to see this new release.
Yeah, one of the cool things about Criterion, like I'm a huge Criterion Collection fan, and I was collecting them for a really long time. I stopped collecting them about 5 years ago, but I basically have every release up until then, and this is the first new one that I've bought in a while, and they're up to something like 800 titles or something like that on their spine numbers. And this one here, what's great about Criterion is the restoration process that they employ to make these films cleaned up. Like they'll go in and they'll digitally remove scratches and splices. Like sometimes the films get torn, you know, and they'll go in and they'll like clean up that tear digitally, so it's almost virtually non-existent when you go in there, right? And so they just look beautiful. They fix the contrast levels. They really, really clean it up. So I highly recommend this. One of the great things about this Criterion release, if you haven't picked it up yet, is there is included a complete new 2K restoration as well of Downhill, which I think is his next film that we'll be discussing. So you get two for the price of one, two complete 2K transfers of some Hitchcock films. So I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, no, that good for them for taking the time and effort to do these restorations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now this, so this is the BFI restoration that we watched is what it is. So it was done a little while ago, but you know, Criterion is one of those companies that does champion and work very hard as well at cleaning up the films. Now Hitchcock considers this the first true Hitchcock film, and it was based on the novel of the same name by Marie Belloc Lowndes, and it was also based on the play co-written by Belloc Lowndes, which is called Who Is He? Now, The Lodger was her most famous novel. It was written in 1913, and it's based on the Jack the Ripper murders of 1888. It's been adapted for the screen many times, Hitchcock's version being the first, but it was also directed by Maurice Elvey in 1932, John Brahms in 1944, a film called The Man in the Attic in 1953, and even as recently as David Ondaatje, I hope I'm saying that right, Ondaatje, in 2009. And even in 1960, there was an opera version of The Lodger for stage by Phyllis Tate.
Wow.
Now, the screenplay for the film was written by Elliot Standard. Now, you may have heard his name before because previously they worked together on Patty the Next Best Thing, The Pleasure Garden, and The Mountain Eagle. And they would work again together on Downhill, The Farmer's Wife, Easy Virtue, Champagne, and The Manxman. An interesting thing about the script was that originally the film was intended to end with ambiguity as to whether or not the lodger was innocent. However, because Ivor Novello was such a large star at the time, the studios would not allow Hitchcock to do that, so they demanded they altered to make it that he was innocent in the end. Spoilers for the movie if you haven't seen it. But so this is Hitchcock's first clash with a star and having to change to meet the demands of a studio. Now, the cinematographer, again, was Gaetano de Vintimiglia, which was the Baron Gontago Vimiglia, blah, 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 de... It's a hard name to say. I'm not good at Italian. Also known as Baron Gaetano di Ventimiglia. And we talked about him last time. Previously, they worked together on The Pleasure Garden and The Mountain Eagle, and this would be the last time that they would work together. The film was again produced by Gainsborough Pictures, and you can go back to episode 5 when we discuss The Pleasure Garden, as I give a little bit of history about them. Now, the film starred Marie Ault, Arthur Chesney, June Tripp, Malcolm Keane, and Ivor Novello. Now, Marie Ault was also in Patty the Next Best Thing and The Prude's Fall, which Hitchcock was a co-director on, a secondary director. June Tripp's probably most famous film out of this was Les Miserables in 1952. And Malcolm Keane played John, Fear a God Fulton, in The Mountain Eagle. And he would also show up again in The Manxman. Now, Ivor Novello, who was born as David Ivor Davies, was a Welsh composer and an actor who became one of the most popular British entertainers of the first half of the 20th century. He would go on to work with Hitch one more time in Downhill, and he would actually also act in the 1932 version of The Lodger with a character named Michael Angeloff. Now, there's many reoccurring themes that The Lodger introduces that Hitchcock would revisit in his later work, such as the innocent man on the run, hunted down by a self-righteous society, and fetishistic sexuality. Hitchcock had clearly been watching contemporary films by Murnau and Lang, whose influence could be seen with the ominous camera angles and claustrophobic lighting. While Hitchcock had made two previous films, in later years the director would refer to The Lodger as his first true film. And that last summary there I got from Wikipedia. Now, Rotten Tomatoes gives the film a 96% rating, certifying it fresh. And Hitchcock himself has two cameos. This is the first time that we get a Hitchcock cameo in any film. And the first one is right near the beginning of the film when he's sitting at the desk in the newsroom. He's facing away from the camera, so we only see his back. And the other scene is near the end of the movie. It's in the mob scene, and he's standing next to Detective Joe, who's bearing the lodger's weight on the fence by holding his arms.
Talking about cameos, what I read here was that... when they came to shoot that scene, they were short extras, and Hitchcock just decided to sit in and be an extra at the desk at the beginning of the film, and that is where his whole tradition of sitting in as a cameo appearance in all the films began.
Yeah, you got it. Now, we have one other cameo that we're going to have to start watching out for the remainder of Hitch's films, and it's a very, very... It's a very, very important one. And it is the first appearance of a drink of brandy in his movies. And going forward, every single Hitchcock film would have brandy in it at some point. The brandy cameo appears when Daisy takes the lodger to the pub for a restorative drink. And it's a crucial appearance in every film henceforth.
You know what, though? Hollywood has a cliche of using brandy or cognac in scenes. You see this on television, on soap operas and movies. And I think part of it is that it's easy to just have a bottle of brandy on the counter in a living room and an empty glass, and they pour someone a drink and they hand it to them. Where like a cocktail with ice and mix and all that would be much more complicated. This is one of my sort of prop cliches that I always notice in film and TV.
And then the last piece of trivia is before the film was released, Hitchcock got married to Alma Revel on December 2nd, 1926.
Aww.
Yeah. So that's our wonderful times that we've got, and that's my little bit of trivia on the film. Chris, you ready to give us a summary of the movie?
I am. I'm caught between either basically giving you the full plot off Wikipedia, which is quite long, or giving you the synopsis off the Hitchcock Zone Wikia, which is really short.
Go for the short one.
Yeah. So,
or the Chris's version, which is right in between.
Yeah. I might expand on it. Who knows? Who knows? So, The Lodger, or to give it its full title, The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog, which is a pretty awesome title, is a 1927 film. The synopsis is thus. A serial killer, known as The Avenger, not to be confused with The Avengers, is on the loose in London, murdering blonde women. A mysterious man arrives at the house of Mr. and Mrs. Bunting, looking for a room to rent. The Bunting's daughter is a blonde model, and is seeing one of the detectives assigned to the case. The detective becomes jealous of the lodger, and begins to suspect he may be The Avenger. I mean, that's a really brief kind of synopsis of it, but... So, the relationship between the Bunting's daughter, Daisy, and the lodger, who is never actually named in the film, it grows, it becomes more serious, and eventually it's led to reveal when the lodger is found to have a... I think it's a newspaper clipping of one of the blonde women... rather than it being kind of an insidious, oh, he really is the serial killer, it's revealed that he is the brother of the first victim who was murdered coming out of a debutante ball. And so he himself has decided to seek vengeance on the Avenger. Eventually, however, he ends up getting mistakenly confused for the Avenger. There's a mass mob scene, and in kind of the film's famous climax, he is... attacked outside railings by this massive kind of mob seeking justice, and it's only when the truth is revealed and the real Avenger is caught that he's finally exonerated, and in the final moments he and Daisy finally get to live their happy ending together. He's still not given a name though, even in the credits, which is a shame.
I think the black leather case was a brilliant device. Brandon and I were actually talking to each other, like, what's in the case?
Yeah.
And Brandon said, well, maybe it's his knives, because it kind of looks like a medical
kit, yeah,
like a doctor's kit. And
oh, yeah,
that was the mystery, and we didn't know. We had no idea what was in there until the police forced him to open the bag. And like you said, it revealed it.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it's like, why does he have photos of victims? He's still guilty. And then, oh, no, sorry, it's a heartwarming personal story about your sister being killed.
Right.
But I was impressed. Like, it was a very suspenseful ending.
Mm-hmm. It was.
One of the great things about the character, though, as well, is one of Hitchcock's styles in directing of this film is the way that he presented the lodger. Like, when we first meet him, he's all presented in black, he's all mysterious, and these are subtle visual clues to make us distrust him and not be on his side. However, later on in the film, once they start accusing him, they change his clothing to a lighter style, which makes us kind of side with him and be more sympathetic with him. Right?
Right,
so it's something, you know, these are things that they did in the silent era. So it's interesting how Hitchcock is manipulating the viewer simply by clothing choices.
And it's something that he would later go on to do with great success. So it's the whole idea, like you said, of the character and his intentions are literally kind of enlightened as the story goes on. And it is a fantastic example of kind of visual storytelling. So you do, because obviously there wasn't sound then. It is really interesting to see it. I mean, I was talking to you guys about this before we started recording, but I was so impressed with the way it was shot, because a lot of the way I've, you know, seen Hitchcock films where it's all very based on a set and there's certain camera angles and it's kind of this way and that way, but the way that the lodger's shot is brilliant and it seems so modern in a way, because a lot of the camera angles used were, for example, there's the opening scene where you're introduced to Daisy, and it's the it's like a chorus line of blonde women, because that's where she works, and they're all talking about, oh, you know, the Avengers struck again, he's killed his seventh victim, and they're all teasing each other about it, and there's like these brilliant mirror shots that kind of reflect, and it's so brilliantly shot throughout, really, that it does increase kind of the tension, it does increase kind of our fear and you know, misunderstanding, because it's worth pointing out as well that Ivan Novello, the actor, he, and I didn't know this until fairly recently, that he would go on to star in a remake 5 years later of the same film, playing the same character, and it sort of makes sense if you look at him, because he has that kind of, I don't describe it, but it's almost a bit kind of Anthony Perkins-ish in that he looks fairly innocent, he looks a bit kind of Johnny, you know, very early Johnny Depp, in that, oh, he's a dark, sensitive hero, that sort of thing, but equally he could play someone flat out weird as well. So it is interesting, the casting choice they went with as well, particularly because Ivan Novello was a matinee idol and they were all very kind of quaffed and very sleek and all that sort of thing. So it's interesting to see how he went from that to, for example, Cary Grant, to Jimmy Stewart, and that over the course of, you know, his career.
There's talk of, from the day that they compared Novello to Noel Coward, and how handsome Novello was and how successful he was. He was a triple threat. He could act, write, and direct. He was the very popular British leading man. One of the things I think is amazing, too, is that 90 years after this film was released, we're still talking about it. That is the historic significance of these Hitchcock films. And remember that this is a story, a film based loosely around Jack the Ripper. So the people of the day in Britain would still know the Jack the Ripper story. And if you're trying to convince yourself how important the Jack the Ripper legend is, remember that not even a month ago, there was a news article talking about how they're still investigating and they're thinking that Jack the Ripper now was two men that were acting together. So this is very legendary. True crime stories, and the film that is based on the true crime.
some of the neat things in this film as well. I mean, we've got a lot of the reoccurring motifs that we would see as well. Like I mentioned before about the innocent man on the run and whatnot. But, you know, a couple other things. I mean, we just had, you know, the showgirls that we saw in the Pleasure Garden. Staircases are hugely important for Hitchcock. I mean, we'd see a staircase become very important in the movie Suspicion and Vertigo. And even in the Pleasure Garden itself, one of the very first shots we see is that circular staircase of all the showgirls going down, you know. And when Daisy's boyfriend, the cop, you know, puts the handcuffs on her in this film, you know, that's kind of a flash forward as well to the 39 Steps, which is another mm-hmm. reoccurring theme with the handcuffs and lovers joined by the handcuffs and stuff. So, you know, we see these weird trends that he continues on with his filmmaking. And it's really fascinating that he returns to these images so frequently, these images that he's fascinated with.
And he loves blonde women.
He loves blonde women, right?
So,
yeah,
Hitchcock blonde. I mean, like, that's a stereotype, basically. Yeah. So we'd see many of those.
And to the point that Daisy, didn't she dye her hair or stop dyeing her hair so it would go brown again? Like, because the killer was killing blonde. It was a huge theme in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did find some of the... And, of course, these are silent films. The acting is different than what we expect in talkies or modern films. But some of the dramatic pauses in the film were so long. And I'm just like, okay, we get it. Move on. Stop staring at the camera, you know. But it I love that vintage film style and watching the old films, watching the old silent film. So, Brandon, and when you and I were watching the film, at the beginning, the Joe the police detective, he comes in as a suitor, a young man that's trying to date Daisy, but we didn't know at mm-hmm. first that he was a cop. We had to think about that.
Yeah. Yeah, we thought, well, he must be just another lodger that's staying there or something like that. It did take us a little bit to kind of figure that out. Now, that's one of the challenges about a silent film, right? I mean, you know, we've said previously how difficult we find it to watch a silent film. But when this was over, I turned to you, Tom, and I said, you know, this was probably the best silent film I've ever seen. And I had no trouble following the plot. I realized as the movie went along that he was the cop and he was dating her and he was her suitor and whatnot. But I was just like, I was captivated in this movie the whole time and I didn't find myself wandering at all.
There's a huge theme of the triangle. The Avenger uses a triangle. Like in the title cards, we see a triangle drawn or cut mm-hmm. in paper. The police detectives are circling a map in a triangle, but there's the love triangle, right? Between Daisy and Joe the policeman and the lodger. And it was captivating because Joe doesn't like the lodger because the lodger is a, you know, his affections are going towards Daisy, so Daisy has to choose between the two men. Joe doesn't like the lodger because he wants to arrest him for being the murderer. The lodger doesn't like Joe because of all the same reasons. And Daisy has to choose between them. Like, it was very compelling, very interesting.
So what did you guys think of the movie itself?
I mean, I was saying to Tom a little while ago, I was saying, as an actual, the plot and everything, it's not the most kind of complex, twisty-turny thing in terms of the structure and everything. And as you've mentioned, originally it was supposed to be a bit more ambiguous, the ending. It was supposed to be a bit like, well, was he actually the Avenger? Did he kill people? And obviously because, you know, they wanted a nice happy ending, it was like, no, of course he can't be the serial killer. We'll change it at the end. But I really enjoyed this. I was similar to you guys in that when I watched it, it was really easy to watch. The version I watched, which is on YouTube, you can find a really good version on YouTube, to watch, it was so kind of, it was very well structured and it was very engaging. And yeah, I mean, I think people who have a bit of an issue with silent films, or they're a bit hesitant or reluctant to kind of dip their toe in them, I think they wouldn't go wrong watching this, because it is effectively a thriller. It is a serial killer movie, but it just happens to be of the silent era, and it is a different way of doing performances, because you don't rely on the dialogue in the traditional sense. It is very visual. It is very much, you have to watch the actors and you have to feed off the emotions in the music and feed off what they're projecting to you. But no, I enjoyed it. I've definitely watched worse movies. I would probably happily watch it again and see if they've got it on DVD. So I was pretty happy.
Title cards are a huge part of these silent films. I was reading how Michael Balkan, the producer, forced Hitchcock to reduce the title cards. There originally were 400 down to 80. So 80 kind of sounds right to me. And I thought the tempo and the speed and the sort of frequency of the title cards was adequate. It didn't leave us wondering too much and it wasn't overdone. And the title cards were fairly unique and fairly distinct and a little bit fancier than some that I've seen on older films. But to imagine that it might have had 400 title cards originally, wow.
Yeah. And Tom, you and I, when we were watching the film, like, we were both talking about the title cards that were on the Criterion Edition, and I'm like, I don't think they would have, but did they update these cards? And, you know, I checked out the version that's on YouTube, which is clearly an older print, right? You know, the colors aren't as clean, the image isn't quite as clear. And no, like, these are the original title cards. Like, the triangles are there. That one murder, like, when it says murder and it, like zooms in and out and comes in and out, like, that's in there. And there was times when he didn't use title cards, but he was using things like when you'd go into the street and you'd see, what are they called when the words go by on in lights?
LED, right? Like a marquee.
Yeah, a marquee. There we go. Like that, that's original. And he would use that for title cards as well, right? Mm-hmm. And the tonight golden curls, right? And how that would shine up in lights and stuff. Like that's that. I thought these were things that possibly Criterion had added or somebody had added in this print, which didn't make sense to me because they seemed such. They didn't seem to fit with all the title cards that I've seen previously, right? Previous title cards are just words with a fancy drawing around the outside or something like this, not motion to these cards, right? So it's really
seeing,
cool.
Seeing the opening titles the way they existed originally, the title cards the way they existed, that's part of the experience of seeing the old film. So to produce modern or fancier or cleaner title cards would be robbing us of the bit of the experience. Chances are they went in and cleaned them up and took out the scratches and took out, you know, tinting issues or contrast issues in the title cards. But I'm guessing, like you said, more than not, they are the same cards and the same credit pages that they would have seen back in the day.
Right.
So, a really good experience, really good film. And I enjoyed, maybe I'm simple, but the simple plot, I really found it interesting and compelling, easy to follow. And obviously, we knew the ending going in, but I was being pulled along at the end to find out how is it revealed that the lodger is not the murderer. He's not the avenger. Mm-hmm. And it was very well done ending for sure.
Mm-hmm. I really like this movie, but I can't. I think just overall, though, it's just an interesting film. And if you're going to, you know, Hitchcock, he said, this is my first kind of official film. It is an interesting way to kick it off. In a way, it does kind of almost go full circle with his filmography because it is based on Jack the Ripper. It took place less than 40 years after the attacks, or, you know, just under 40 years. So a lot of the moviegoers and a lot of the people at the time would have been very aware of this and aware of the influences. You know, in the UK, it's still a big thing, is Jack the Ripper. In a really, really perverse way, he's a bit of a national icon. And we don't even know who he is. Like, I promise you, every 6 months in, like, the Daily Mail or something, there's always, like, did this person, was they, you know, Jack the Ripper, or did he do all that sort of thing? And so it is still a bit of a national obsession. It's a low-key one, but it is that. And so when you were talking about, there's the, you know, the black briefcase and how it was, because it was a little bit of a MacGuffin for the first half, and it was like, okay, so what's actually going on there? Could it be the tools or that sort of thing? Because one of the big theories is that the Ripper was the personal doctor of Queen Victoria. And Read From Hell by Alan Moore, and it basically explains it, the theory, a lot better. I think it's Edward Gull, and the name of this guy. So it's like, it's like a doctor's kit, and that's how he kills them. You know, and so it's a big thing there. But then if you go all the way to the end of, you know, the Hitchcock filmography, and second to last, you've got Frenzy, which is very similar to this film in a lot of ways. So you deal with a guy who's wrongfully accused, you deal with a string of female murders, it takes place in London, and they are kind of the twin of each other. So it is really interesting to look at it from that perspective.
One of the similarity things is, I mean, like this guy here, the lodger, he's not completely innocent, right? I mean, he's planning on killing this Avenger. Like, we find out that he's simply hunting him down. But, I mean, his goal, he's premeditated murdering this guy. And
it's a
revenge
killing, though.
He's avenging. He's an Avenger himself, right? And, I mean, the same thing with Frenzy, right? Where, you know, the innocent man of the rape murder sees with violence. Like, he plans killing the real murderer as well, right? So, you know, that's even this main character is not completely innocent as well, right?
No, I mean, I suppose there is intent and everything, but yeah, it does mirror it. The one thing, and this is just like a tiny point which I thought was quite funny in the film, is the fact that the room they pick for the lodger just walks in, and it's like you can see it, the walls are just full of pictures of blonde women. And I just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. It's just basically like going, ah, yes, clearly you're not the murderer. Look at all these photos of random blonde women and our daughter, who is blonde, and this is all going to be fine. I just watched that and I just burst out laughing. I thought it was the funniest thing.
Yeah,
like they picked the one room in the house where it's like, ah, yes, we'll put you in the blonde room. Why is it called the blonde room? Well, because that's where we keep the collection of every blonde person we've ever known.
You don't like this one? Did you want the ginger room?
Yeah. see, there's a guy already in the brunette room, so
yeah.
We're really sorry. I just thought that was really funny.
It's a theme boarding house.
Yeah.
I just thought it was just like, is that, did you know, did Mr. and Mrs. Button, did they suspect? And they thought, listen, if he goes crazy, he was the Avenger because he couldn't stand being in the blonde room. So
we had some comment about the house, the boarding house itself. Brandon, were you saying that the banisters were quite loose?
Yeah, I was like, they were, like when they were walking down the stairs and stuff, like things were shaking and, you know, I'm like, ooh, is this a set that's just not quite built right? But
the room itself with all those paintings, when they move the paintings and like there's filth surrounding.
Well, that was neat. Like, that was neat because
a rag?
Well, I don't clean my walls. How often do you wash your walls, Tom?
I'm the tall one in the house. I always have to clean the walls.
Man, but, I've been living in this house for 7 years. I don't think we washed our walls once. I think like the kids spilt something and I had to clean that spot. But I mean, like, we don't wash our walls. Like, am I just a disgusting person or what?
Yes.
I clean my toilets, but I mean, we don't clean our walls. We don't smoke or anything.
The whole, hey, I'm going to walk right into your dining room of your apartment and bring you food. Like, the access, the idea that the boarding staff, that Mrs. Bunting and, you know, they just walk in and here's a tray of food. Like, there's no privacy. And I'm sure that's maybe how a boarding house or a bed and breakfast works. But it just seems very odd that there's never that barrier of the locked door. Mm-hmm. It's just an open house.
Now, was there any shots in this film that really stood out to you? I can think of a couple. Any really amazing shots that we saw in this film?
The glass floor, the glass ceiling was very famous.
Oh,
yeah. Very innovative, very expensive to produce.
I couldn't believe how he did that. So for those that haven't watched the movie, so the lodger is like pacing in his room, apartment, which is above another room in the house. So everybody else is standing in this one room below him, and he's walking along. And so how they convey it, that they can hear him, is number one, the chandelier is, like, shaking a little bit, like, to show, like, I don't know.
Because the house is loose.
The house is loose, I guess, eh? If we're going to fall apart. But then also, looking up, we see past it, and it fades to this glass floor. And so the guy's walking above, and we can see him walking through this glass floor. And it's really fascinating. It's a really unique visual. And that's one thing that we will get to see out of most of Hitchcock's films. There's going to be some kind of a really striking visual at some point in just about every one of these movies. I mean, Vertigo, we're going to have the first use of that, of the lens where they pull the focus, right? They pull the camera away, but they zoom the lens so that the center image stays the same size, but everything else looks like it's going away and warps away, right? So that's how that effect's created. And, I think it's Sabotage, where the guy falls from the Statue of Liberty and they pull the camera away from him. And, Frenzy, I think it is, with the murders and her tongue sticking out of her mouth. Like, there's always, like, a striking visual in Hitchcock's films. And this is definitely that one. Another one that really struck me is when the lodger first gets to his room and he looks out on the street and the lights are shining on him. And the window panes make a cross image on his face, like this holy religious symbol on his face. Like, I don't know. I think that was a pretty fascinating visual as well.
The Hitchcock theme of not seeing the murders, the women that are murdered, I believe they're typically at a dance party or at a society ball. We see the scene after they're found. We do not see the murder itself. He's very, very serious throughout his career about never really showing you the gore, letting you imagine the gore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, particularly in this one, but because of, we were talking a bit about Frenzy and everything, he subverts that then, because the film opens with, the body of the woman floating in the river and the necktie murders and all that sort of thing. But then he completely subverts his own rule and he kills Blaney's wife. I can't remember her first name, I feel really bad, but Blaney's wife, the kind of sex therapist, psychologist, whatever, she gets the most kind of, and it's really uncomfortable, she gets the most uncomfortable, most visual death. I think it's the most kind of graphic death that Hitchcock has done, because he has killed people on screen before, but particularly something like this, it's so, visceral and angry and horrible. But yeah, I mean, that is kind of the rule, though. Whenever Hitchcock's got like a serial killer going, it's always like, oh no, a woman was found after leaving a party in the woods, or something like that. But yeah, generally he doesn't like to kill on camera, but then I think he likes to subvert his own rules.
Is the woman that's the victim typically a woman of some type of reputation or some type of loose morals, and that makes her a victim or puts her in the situation that she gets attacked?
It would tie into the kind of the Ripper thing, because obviously the women in the Jack the Ripper case, they were all kind of prostitutes, sex workers, so it would tie into that a bit. But
the woman that attends the society ball and she's a dancer and she's dancing with the men, like that, in the morals of the day, that's a little
in the morals of the day, she's the equivalent of the girl in the 80s slasher film who gets a top off. That's sure. Who she is. She's the one who doesn't make it past the opening credits.
Yeah.
Oh, bless her.
Cool. Now, there's one other reoccurring theme in this. I didn't want to give them all at the same time here. But the film opens up with a screaming girl, a screaming woman close up. And this is another theme that we'd see throughout a lot of Hitchcock's films. The first shot of To Catch a Thief, a woman screaming that she's been robbed. The Man Who Knew Too Much, Doris Day screams at the Albert Hall, and that fills the screen. And in Psycho, Janet Leigh screams as she sees her attacker. So that's another reoccurring theme in this. So, I mean, all in all, this is a film that we're definitely going to recommend for sure. Everybody's got to see it. Now, I had reached out on Twitter and Facebook. We didn't get as much response this time as we did last time. But the question I said was, we'll be recording The Lodger. Have you seen it? And what do you think? And the only person that did respond to us is Becca. And I believe that's Chris's friend. She says, one of Hitch's all-time classics. Love the glass walking scene. So effective. So right on, Becca. I appreciate your interaction. We appreciate it a lot. And if you want to check us out on Twitter, just follow us at Good Evening Pod. Yeah, so next episode, we'll be talking about Bates Motel Season 1. So if you want to watch along with that before we record the episode, we're going to ask for some comments as well. But basically, it's the prequel to Psycho. So we're going to start with our Psycho series because we want to intersperse it. We don't want to just talk about Psycho like all the time for like months and months and months at a time. Because again, we're only doing one episode a month.
That's enough to drive you psycho.
It's enough to drive you psycho, yeah. So we're going to intersperse it in between. But if you want to follow along, season one's only 10 episodes long. I watched it. I really enjoyed it. It's not as good as the movie, of course, but I mean, it's fun. There's some cheesy plot lines in it, but I really enjoy it, and I think it's really good. And in case you missed it, the last episode, we actually did an interview with Chris Bacon, who was the composer for Bates Motel. So make sure you
go
back
and
check that out.
Very interesting. Good job getting that interview. And thanks to Chris for talking to us.
Yeah. And so after that, after The Lodger, we'll be talking. The next film we'll be talking about is The Ring. So episode 8 is going to be Bates Motel Season 1, and episode 9 will be The Ring, followed by Downhill. So we got a couple of cool movies coming along.
Brandon, how can people get a hold of you?
Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter, at Brandon Metella, where I tweet lots about the projects I'm working on, lots of film stuff. You can find me over on Trek FM, where I'm wrapping up Melodic Treks. There's just one or two episodes left of that, which is my podcast all about the music of Star Trek. So that's almost done. Warp 5, you can find me on Trek FM with my friend Floyd Dorsey. That's where we talk about Star Trek Enterprise. And if you like this show and behind-the-scenes information, we've been doing a lot of interviews over there with writers and actors and producers of that show. And just launched this month, we have our Star Trek Discovery podcast, which is called The Edge. And I will be rotating hosts on that one. So that'll be released on Fridays, every Friday on Trek FM. I won't be
May
on every
that podcast episode. Live long and prosper.
Yeah. Excellent. Chris, where can people find you when you're not stalking the night for your sister's murderer?
Well, when I'm not doing that for the sister I don't have, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. My Twitter is nowhere near as productive as Brandon Shear's. I don't really talk about the projects I'm doing. It's mainly me going, oh, that's nice. Just talking about stuff and chatting to people. I am the co-host of North by Nerd West, which is kind of a nerdy chat about anything podcast that I host with one of my best friends, Emma Platt. You can find her at The Crushinator. Yeah, it's The Crushinator on Twitter. But yeah, the podcast is a lot of fun. We are on iTunes. We are on Blogger. So make sure you check us out there. And if you want to send any, you know, messages or talk about Hitchcock or anything, you're more than welcome to tweet me or send me a message or anything like that.
Excellent. And Tom, where can people find you when you're not contemplating on whether or not you should continue to dye your hair blonde?
Instagram, IMDb, I'm known as the Tom Caldwell. Usually those are very hard sites to get onto because the traffic is so intense. People are chasing me always. And yeah, that's the best place to find me. And of course, we're on Facebook under Hitchcock Good Evening. The Facebook and Twitter sites that we try to maintain for this podcast are very interactive, and we really encourage interaction, questions, comments, and photos, anything you want to send, please send it forward.
Cookies. Please send cookies.
Chocolate chip.
Cookies.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And you can also find us.
That was the best episode we've ever produced.
Is it? Excellent. Don't forget, you can also find us on the Fandom Podcast Network. We don't have our own feed yet, but I think we're working on that. So you have to subscribe to the master feed or download each episode. You can find them over on Twitter at FanPod Network. And they're on Facebook. Just search Fandom Podcast Network. And our show is on Twitter at Good Evening Pod. So please interact with us. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Some of the furniture in Brandon Shea's basement is of the era of this film, too, so it was very authentic.
What?
No, that was a compliment.
Teasing my couch?
That was a bit of shit.
bizarre.